Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. This morning's guests all have a sense of adventure and daring do. We'll hear from a woman who raffled off her middle name as a fundraiser for the Upper Valley Trail Alliance. We'll talk to the person whose job it is to tell the world about the wonders of Vermont. We'll also meet a gentleman who left the world of finance and accounting to chase his dreams of forestry at the age of 50. But we start with a person who leads a project that is testing pee and poop at Norwich University to make sure there is no COVID about. Well, checking wastewater for coronavirus, just one of the things she's doing at the Northfield campus. Tara Kulkarni is a professor of civil and environmental engineering and is the director of the Center for Global Resilience and Security at Norwich. Tara, nice to have you on the program today.
Hi, Rick. Good morning. Thanks for the invite. I'm really happy to be here.
Great. And listeners, if you have wanted to understand the connection between wastewater and the coronavirus, now's your chance to get answers. You can give us a call at 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. That's 877-291-TALK. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Tara, what are you testing this wastewater for?
Well, Rick, I think the answer is in your introduction. We're looking for the genetic traces of the SARS-CoV-2 virus in the wastewater. So we're looking in treatment plant samples and also samples that are collected from our campus manhole location.
So how do you get the samples from those locations?
That's a great question. It took us a while to get all of that set up. So it turns out our treatment plants collect these 24-hour composite samples on a weekly basis. And when I say 24-hour composite, I mean every hour on the hour, a little bit of a sample is pulled in. And that over a 24-hour period gives us a nice composite. So wastewater treatment plants are doing this because they have to meet their own testing requirements for permits. And so we were just able to reach out and go collect a sample from them. On campus, though, collecting from manholes, well, that's been a completely different story. We've had really incredible support and help from our facilities folks on campus. So we've looked at all the engineering drawings, opened up a whole bunch of manholes to see how deep they are, whether the lids are even popping out. And then we are able to either collect samples from the manhole using containers that can be lowered into the manhole and just grab a sample. So that's a snapshot. Mm. Or we have these students, my really incredible students who designed an automatic sampler. So this is where we use a pump and are able to collect that same kind of 24-hour composite sample, but using our home-built auto sampler, which is very cool.
So does somebody have to be out there at 3 a.m. to take off a manhole cover and grab a sample, or do they not?
No, that's the best part. By setting it up to do this automatically, the students can set up the sample collection device or this auto sampler anytime. Wow. So at a time that actually works out reasonable for them between classes and everything else that they have going on, and then they just have to go back a day later around the same time to collect that 24-hour sample.
That's fantastic. And you can tell from a sample of wastewater that someone or several people in a specific area have the coronavirus.
Yeah, that's the idea. So most people are asymptomatic, or even if you are asymptomatic, we are shedding the virus in our stools and our feces if we are infected. And so the idea is that the wastewater sample will offer an early indicator of what's to come. So oftentimes, unless you're feeling awful and showing some symptoms, you may not go in to get a medical test. And so you might not know that you're infected and have the virus, whereas you could be asymptomatic and shedding the virus. And so by collecting this wastewater sample and looking for that genetic code for the SARS-CoV-2, we have a sense of analyzing and then knowing if in fact there is an infection.
Why is feces, I can't believe I'm asking this question, but why is feces a good place to test for COVID?
Well, it just happens to be one of the ways in which the virus exits your system. As we know with SARS-CoV-2, because it's a respiratory type of a virus, it kind of, the nasal swab is because that's where you're going to find the most prevalence. You can also vomit and throw up. I'm sorry to be gross this morning. But, you know, that's another way in which the virus might be leaving your system, but it also comes out a little bit in urine, so we can't really track it very successfully in urine, but it does come out in pieces, and different people will share different amounts. So it's definitely an evolving science, and we're all trying to learn as much as we can.
So you find that there is COVID after you've sampled a specific area. What happens then? I mean, what can you tell from that?
So I think to backtrack a little bit, once we collect the sample, because, and especially here in Vermont and several of our communities, we have combined sewer systems. That means you have the rainwater and your sewage or wastewater kind of going in the same pipeline.
Right.
And so the sample itself might be pretty dilute. And so the first step is, of course, to try and concentrate the sample. And then we have to extract the virus and then look for the genetic code. So all of that takes a little bit of time. And so if we do get a positive in one of these tests, then you know that there is an infection depending on where that sample came from. So in our case, if we have a sample collected from a manhole that's connected to a specific building on campus, if we get a positive, then we know someone in that building who contributed to this sample has an infection. And so it allows us to then prioritize resources, right? So we might require all of those students or all of the individuals in that building to quarantine and go get the medical nasal swab kind of test performed. And that then allows us to kind of, like I said, prioritize the resources and make sure that if there is an outbreak, we're catching it early, we're taking care of the person who might be infected early, and that is the advantage.
Have you been able to find anyone who has COVID-19 in this manner?
Yes, so we started our sample collection towards the middle of November, and we collected some grab samples and the 24-hour composite samples because we finally built our auto-sampler and were able to collect samples from these manholes on campus. And then the lab was just getting set up to do the analysis. So that's when we did find a couple of positive results in the manholes. And then we had students who were connected to that manhole in those buildings quarantine and go get the medical testing done the next day. There were some positive results. And, of course, the students had to quarantine and take care of themselves.
Wow. So has this kind of testing, this wastewater testing, has this been used to detect other diseases or viruses in the past?
It has. I think polio is probably a good example. And the idea is the same. So polio, as you know, worldwide, we successfully eradicated a lot of it. There's a few countries. I think there were three at the around 2003 that were still experiencing some cases of polio. But in Israel, at Ben Gurion University, they were able to kind of use the wastewater surveillance kind of technique. And the idea is the same. If you're seeing the virus in wastewater, it's probably because there are people who are asymptomatic and haven't maybe even had the medical testing yet. So if you're seeing it in the wastewater, the researchers there were able to correlate that with either cases in the community or later on vaccines that are being administered in the community and how effective they've been. And so just over a lot of time, there has been a lot of use of wastewater analysis for different kinds of diseases. And this is just one of them. Others have been waterborne diseases, and so naturally wastewater would be a good platform, a good medium to test in.
Well, Tara Kulkarni, I want to talk about the students who are involved in this. Is this do they get assigned this as a detention or something? I mean, and are they all like biochem students who are involved with this program?
Wow, that's a great question. And I think far from detention, these students are some of our superstars. So
wow.
I have to say, I have five students who are working with me. They're construction management and civil engineering senior year students. So this is their capstone project. So let me tell you, it's so much more. They really are super service-minded. Four of them are cadets. One is a civilian. But they all share this value of service. So if you don't mind, I'm going to name some of them.
Sure, go right ahead.
So Luknath Mahadev, Connor Rulin, Mao Mao Yan, and Elias Mushaheen are all cadets. And Nirmal Tamang is a civilian student. And they're all, I guess, heart and soul into this, regardless of the fact that we're dealing with poo and pee. and they're really committed to design, to building, to service. And then we have three students who are working with my colleague, Professor Marie Agin, who heads up our scientific team. And so Samantha Gonzalez, Gracie Dominguez, and Mallory Dutil. These are our chemistry, biochemistry students. And Mallory has graduated but still engaged in this way. And we have a couple of communication students who are working with my colleague, Dr. Stephen Pite. So Jack Schultz and Jamie Heath, they are incredible. They're developing a podcast on everything that they're doing. And, you know, it's a great way to bring in the arts and humanities into this, what seems like a STEM-heavy subject,
right,
because they want to be the bridge. They want to communicate this science and engineering in a way that's accessible to everyone around us.
What a brilliant idea. Tara Kulkarni, let's talk about that sampler that you talked about a little bit earlier. Who designed it, and does it do the work of the more expensive samplers?
I think that's a great question, Drake. Thanks for asking it, because this is where I want to kind of shine the light on my superstar students once again. The design originally came from Syracuse University. So when the COVID analysis for our campus started, and then we decided we want to kind of jump into what a lot of other universities across the country and the world are doing, I had reached out to several colleagues at other institutions that are doing similar work, and Dr. Dave Larson at Syracuse was really generous enough to send this article that was in preprint where they had designed this homemade auto sampler. So my students took that and they tweaked it for our Vermont special conditions in terms of weather. They, you know, helped in ordering all the supplies, assembled it, tested it in the lab. And then before they all left on break, we tested it in the field. And so, yes, it does what we needed to do. It's not maybe 100% comparable to the commercially available auto samplers. Those cost upwards of $4,000 a piece. But then they have the ability of texting you when the sample is collected and so on, which ours doesn't, but then ours also cost less than $1,000, which means we can tap into many, many manholes with a much smaller budget as compared to what we'd have to set aside for those commercial units.
How many do you have there at Norwich?
We just have the one right now, and we are in the process of ordering supplies to build at least eight more.
Wow. So how do you see this helping local communities?
I think this is truly at the heart of what we're trying to do, Rick. So Norwich truly embodies our service mission, and so our original goal with this project was to keep our campus community safe, our Northfield and surrounding areas safe. And over time, as we develop this technique of sampling and analysis and have a method to our madness, so to speak, our hope is to make this testing and analysis available to any communities that need us. We've had some requests for information from a couple of different community members, and right now they're on hold because we're still trying to figure out the best protocols for our campus and how to get this started. Once we have it, the idea is that, especially in underrepresented communities or those that don't have a lot of access to medical testing, the wastewater analysis might be a good way to catch some of the outbreaks or get that early warning signal. And so we could help out by showing communities how to test, where to test in terms of collecting samples, and then use our lab facilities to analyze samples for them at a very low price or at cost, depending on once all the setup is ready for that kind of mass analysis.
But Tara, will this whole project and this sampler kind of be moot when the vaccine is widely available?
I think on the contrary, partly we want to find out how the population does and how our public health or our community health responds to the vaccine. So I believe at least for the foreseeable future, we want to kind of keep testing and helping add to the data that CDC is collecting nationwide. Actually, there's a national sewage surveillance system or NEWS that the CDC has set up that's requesting the wastewater data from across health departments, local, municipal, and statewide. So we could keep feeding into that database so we have a better sense of how communities are responding to the virus. And then in the future, we hope to kind of shift away from coronavirus and use this wastewater-based epidemiology to look for flu and other pathogens that are always there. And we know that SARS-CoV-2 is not going to be the last pathogen. So we want to be ready for when the next one comes, as we know it will, and then have this infrastructure set up so we can quickly be there for our communities when that happens.
My favorite thing that you said so far this morning is when we shift away from the coronavirus. We all can't wait for that, Dr. Kulkarni. Yeah. Hey, so what did the board or whomever you had to go to think about this project involving wastewater and, you know, grabbing samples from under manhole covers?
Well, the board in this case is really the university president. And let me tell you, he's been on board since day one. So President Anarumo just took over at Norwich University as president this past summer. Mm-hmm. And he's been a champion of this project, so much so that he was volunteering to be the first one down in the manhole when we're ready for sample collection and testing. And we had to hold him off because, you know, we don't want to violate any OSHA guidelines. But it's been fantastic. He heard about this initiative, obviously, from other universities, and my colleague Marie Egan approached him with wanting to do this at the university. I've been working with a student over the summer looking at coronavirus in water supplies, and so it all kind of came to this really great interdisciplinary group. And I think that's the best part about working and being at a small institution like Norwich. And they're small in terms of numbers, but let me tell you, it's big heart, right? And so it's really great to be able to work with colleagues across disciplines, bring our students who stand shoulder to shoulder as equal partners in this work, and then make some magic happen, like really understand what's going on and how we can help, and just keep as many of our people safe.
Well, Norwich, definitely a school that teaches leadership, and it's great to know that the president wouldn't ask anybody to do anything that he won't do himself, even if it means climbing down to test wastewater. That's a pretty great example. I want to ask you a little bit, though, more about the Center for Global Resilience and Security before you leave. We only have a few minutes. But, you know, for a non-academic, it's a tough idea. I'm not sure I understand it. So just give me a sense of what the Center for Global Resilience and Security is all about.
Absolutely, Rick. So let's start with our mission. It's to build resilient communities. And the way we want to do that is by looking at four areas: water, energy, climate change, and infrastructure. And we kind of recognize we're not a big research school, so our goal was always to look at the scenes or the intersections of these areas and using a national security lens. And so, as an example, one of the projects we have going on right now is focused on the Dog River. It's the river that kind of flows in our veins. It's in our backyard on campus. And the idea is to teach and to educate, do outreach in the communities about water conservation and how that links to community health and eventually to the health and resilience of the state. We also coordinate activities for the Resilient Vermont Network. And then on the more national global scale, we're looking at energy resilience curriculum development for the Army installations and operations, and also are looking really closely at the environmental security issues. This is where environmental degradation can cause conflict and vice versa. And so we have some great partnerships and, again, wonderful opportunities for students to become leaders. Like you were saying, we definitely are the testbed for leadership, and then do this as a way of learning and researching, but also as service.
It really seems like there's a lot of hands-on applicable work being done there right now.
Absolutely. We wouldn't have it any other way. Experiential is what our founder preached all those 200 years ago, and that's the model that we want to kind of keep taking ahead with us.
And has the pandemic limited what students are able to experience at college this year?
In some ways, yes. And in other ways, I feel that they are being shown a different way of doing things. So they're all adapting and being resilient, no pun intended there. But they're learning how to make do in virtual spaces. We've seen bigger audiences in some of the virtual events they're holding because people can log in and it's away from issues related to commute. Of course, there's nothing like being in person and seeing that body language and reaction from your audience and so on. And so, yeah, there's some things we all missed, just being able to give hugs and walk and talk and eat with each other. But on the other hand, everyone's adapting. And I feel like as long as they're still learning and growing, it's all good.
Excellent. Tara Kulkarni is the director of the Center for Global Resilience and Security at Norwich University, where she is also a professor of civil and environmental engineering. Tara, it was great having you on the program this morning. Thank you.
Well, thanks, Rick. I appreciate having the opportunity to talk for my really cool team. Thank you.
It is cool. And we'll be back to talk with Katie Eddington, who came up with a unique way to raise money. That's after the CBS News update here on WDEV.
Things are strange right now, but we are here for you at the Warren Store. Whether curbside or in-store, our newly renovated state-of-the-art deli will be putting out sandwiches, soups, salads, and grab-and-go meals. Check out our website for menus and hours. Lattes coming soon. New upstairs, Free People, Burt's Bees baby clothes, Tabitha Henry luminaries, holiday ornaments, cards, and much more. We hope to be online soon for your shopping convenience. Stay safe, follow the governor's guidelines, and have a healthy, happy holiday season. Fun, funky, and friendly, the Warren Store. Main Street, Warren Village.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. I've done a few, I guess you could call them crazy things, to raise money for charities. I've done the Penguin Plunge 5 times in Lake Champlain and 2 times in Lake Memphremagog. 1 year I did them both. Those are for Special Olympics Vermont. I've walked the Boston Marathon in just over 7 hours for the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, but I think those pale in comparison to what our next guest cooked up. She auctioned off her middle name to raise money for the Upper Valley Trails Alliance, and that might be more dangerous than crazy. Katie Eddington is the program manager for the Alliance, and she joins us now. Katie, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Good morning, and thank you for having me.
Oh, absolutely. If you'd like to ask Katie about what she's done or what the Trails Alliance does, you can call us at 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. All right, Katie, you weren't given a middle name at birth, so when did the yearning begin to have one?
Well, when I was about 8 years old, I mean, like you mentioned, I didn't have a middle name, and I kind of thought that was normal. But as soon as I got into school and realized that most of my peers had a middle name, it kind of felt like I was missing out on something. So I started to ask my parents if I could have a middle name. And eventually my mom, we were at a bookstore, and she said, well, why don't you look around at these books, and if you find a name that you like, you can go ahead and pick that. That'll be your new middle name. So I started going through the aisles of books, and I came across this author whose first name was Satin, like the fabric, and thought that was so original, and decided, you know what, that is my new middle name. And of course, you know, being a kid, I thought, to make it legally binding, all I have to do is write it on my homework. But I kept spelling it wrong. I was writing S-A-T-A-N on days worth of homework assignments. And this resulted in a concerned phone call home from my parent, from my teacher to my parents, and I was so embarrassed about it that I just dropped it.
Katie Satan Addington did not take, nor did no. Satin. Did that put you off middle names for a while, or until recently?
It did. It did. I totally dropped the issue until I was telling this story to a bunch of my students out on the trails. We do a program called the Upper Valley High School Trail Corps Program, where we take high school age kids out on the trails, and we teach them how to build trails in a sustainable way. And the fun thing about working with them on the trails is that they want to get to know you, not just as a leader or your role in the, you know, the organization you work for, but as a person. And this story came up. I can't remember how it came up, but the kids got a huge kick out of it, and one of them actually suggested this fundraiser. One of the students said, well, why don't you crowdsource your middle name?
Oh, wow. Oh, my gosh. That is how it was born, huh? Well, yes. So that was the fundraiser was for the Upper Valley Trails Alliance. Why don't you tell us what the alliance is?
Sure thing. So the Upper Valley Trails Alliance, we are an organization that builds and maintains trails in the Upper Valley region, but we are also an organization that's designed to connect people, organizations, and towns, not just to trails, but to each other.
And how big an area does the Upper Valley Trails Alliance cover?
So we cover about 43 towns. The furthest north that we that's in our service area is Reigate, Vermont, and the furthest south is Charlestown, New Hampshire.
Oh, wow. That's quite an area that you cover. And what does a program manager do at the Upper Valley Trails Alliance?
So my job, being a small organization, we all have we wear a bunch of different hats and we step into different roles. But primarily, I manage the Passport to Winter Fun program, which is a kids' fitness incentive program that's designed to keep elementary age students outdoors and physically active during the winter.
You also do a number of events in a non-COVID year. So what are the events that you're responsible for?
So we have about four annual events. We have the UVTA Skate-a-thon at Lake Maury, and we have the annual dinner. We also have a Stoked Trail Race, which is a fun trail run just over in Hanover, New Hampshire. And then the crowd favorite is the UVTA Tour to Taste, which is our pedaling picnic that takes place every September.
Oh, that sounds phenomenal. Come on, COVID, get out of the way. We want that to come back for next year. Tell us a little bit about that one.
So the Tour to Taste, it's a pedaling picnic, which means we participants can sign up for three different routes, kind of like a small, medium, and large route. And along the way, there are various food stops that have, they're like little rest stations, but they have food that's been donated by local restaurants. So as people go along these routes, they have probably by the end of it a full meal of small donated food items that not only are delicious, but they also showcase local businesses from around the Upper Valley.
That is a phenomenal idea. And hope that happens again in September of 2021. Now, I'm going to get back to your middle name. And so the suggestion was that you should auction off your middle name. Someone would be able to name you. Explain exactly, you know, the logistics of how this was going to work.
Yeah, sure. So we started out with six names on the ballot. But in August, when this first launched, we had an option where people could pay $50 to add their own name to the ballot. So that ticket was available for purchase until the end of August, and then that was closed, and we had about 12 names after all was said and done. And through September and October, we slowly took off the names that had the lowest votes, but we had 12 on the ballot.
To start with, in September, and people would pay, what you said, $50 to suggest a name, and then what would they pay to vote for a name?
So votes were $10 a piece.
Okay. And any of that original 12 that were really kind of out there that you're happy that you don't have as a middle name today, Katie Eddington?
Oh, certainly. My sweet aunt, who I'm so grateful supported me, she originally pitched Humu Humu Nuku Nuku Apua, which is the state fish of Hawaii. Which, well, it is a very unusual name, but it's also really long.
But you say it so well. You've got it memorized.
Oh, thank you. I'm natural. No, I was relieved not to have to write that on everything for the rest of forever.
I would really love if you had gotten that name and then moved to the town in Wales that has the longest name in the world.
No. I would have had to do something like this for them too, maybe.
Once you started the process, did you ever have any regrets?
I didn't have any regrets. I was mostly excited. It was a combination of nervous excitement. So nerve excitement, if that's the thing.
It is now.
Yeah.
Hey, people are giving you a middle name. You can make up words. You can do whatever you want now, right?
I've earned it.
you have indeed. And you remain committed to accepting the name no matter the outcome.
Yes, I will. Now that the fundraiser is closed, I will be submitting for my new middle name, which I found out in Vermont means I have to appear before a judge.
Oh, well, we'll learn
so
more about
be fun
that.
To explain.
Yeah, we're going to learn more about that. Katie, we're going to let that middle name excitement build up a little bit and go back to some of your work at the Trails Alliance. You mentioned the Passport for Winter Fun program. Give us some details about what that entails.
Sorry, Rick, you cut out for just a second.
Oh, sure.
Do you mind repeating the question?
Absolutely. You mentioned earlier the Passport to Winter Fun program. So give us some details about that, what that entails.
Sure thing. So the Passport to Winter Fun, like I mentioned before the break, is a fitness incentive program that's designed to keep kids K through 6 outdoors and physically active. So we give all those who sign up to participate a little booklet that's a journal style way for them to keep track of the physical activity they did for a day. They fill out these little boxes of what they did to play outside. And then as they reach certain milestones in the passport, they qualify to cash in incentive prizes. And all of these incentive prizes have been donated by local businesses, things like a free ski pass for the day or a chance to go indoor swimming, stuff like that.
So if they work out and fill out the passport, then they get free opportunities to work out and do more physical activity.
Right.
Just saying. I see what you're doing, and it's a great idea.
Right. You know, be more motivated to be more active by being active in prizes, right?
You are the most brilliant person on earth, Katie Eddington.
Oh, thank you.
All right. Back to the Katie Eddington middle name quest. Of the final four names that people voted on, what two got eliminated in the semifinals?
Oh, let me think. I think the last two, it was... I think it came down to one of them was Marie. And then another one was, I think it was, wait for it, dot, dot, dot.
Oh, so hikety hike hike got eliminated earlier than that?
Oh, you know what? I think you're right. I think it was hikety hike hike that made it to the top four. Got to get my own facts straight.
At that point, were you rooting for Marie, or do you think, no, I don't want anything that normal?
It's funny because as people submitted their own names, it was a good combination of really out there and normal. So I think, you know, hikety hike hike Marie. Of course, it's between one that's really out there and one that's semi-normal. So
yeah.
I would have been happy with either of them, but certainly I think I was kind of rooting for a more out there name in my heart.
And so, were you starting to like check it out, like doodling on your Trapper Keeper, you know, your full name? Were you doing stuff like that?
Right. You're writing it out to see if it sounds good.
That's right. All right.
Certainly was.
Yeah, I know that. When this started, how much did you think this crazy idea would raise?
Oh, I really have no idea. It was so unpredictable in the beginning because, you know, $10 a vote, that I feel like that's a good way for people to be like, oh, it's only $10. I can certainly contribute, you know, this much amount or whatever. I wasn't sure if people were like, I can't seriously be paying to name a person. So I think I expected, you know, as low as $500 and as high as $1,500. Sure. Mm-hmm.
But you underestimated humankind who want to help and also want to saddle a person with a middle name that they themselves don't have to have. So how much have you raised so far, Katie Eddington?
We ended up raising more than $5,000.
Wow.
Which blew our expectations out of the water.
Do the people at the Upper Valley Trails Alliance love you even more now because of if it's even possible? Do they carry you around on their shoulders or?
Yes, they've certainly sung my praises more so this year than any of my other years working at the Trails Alliance. That's for sure.
I can't wait to see your performance review after all this is done, right?
Right. Not too shabby.
Yeah, when you get to the end of it, you say, hey, what about that middle name thing I did for us all?
Right. Never forget.
All right. We got rid of Marie. We got rid of Hikety Hike Hike and several others. So what were the final two names, the final two middle names that it came down to?
So the top two names were Lark, like a songbird, and Danger.
Wow. And this was done on a lark, so that's really actually quite a good name. And who suggested those names?
So Lark was pitched by my mom.
Oh.
And it's funny because Lark did so well, and it didn't occur to me why, because, you know, it sounds relatively normal. I was really surprised that it did well. But then I realized that a lot of New Englanders are bird watchers.
True.
So of course, a lot of them are like, oh, Lark is so pretty.
Katie Lark Eddington almost sounds like it's a maiden name or something. It's pretty. Katie Lark Eddington.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. So, yeah. And then Danger was actually my husband's idea.
Oh, of course. Of course it was. Katie Danger Eddington. I mean, you have to say it with a certain emphasis.
Right.
Wow. All right. You said that you'd legally change your name to the one that won. So which one won?
Danger won. it was neck and neck up till the very last minute. I stopped looking at the votes. I think it closed midnight on Halloween, and I stopped looking at the votes earlier in the evening just because I wanted to be really surprised. And when I stopped looking, they were separated by 2 votes.
Wow.
But Danger ended up winning with a total of 97 votes.
You didn't happen to notice that, like, your joint bank account with you and your husband all of a sudden was drained by, like, $1,000.
No, my husband definitely didn't rig the election.
Okay.
If that's what you're suggesting.
That is what I'm suggesting. I think he very much loves being married to a dangerous woman. Is that...
Right, and I think he definitely texted our friends and family and said, you know, it closes tonight. Danger is the one I want. So he might have sent the call out, but I don't think it came from him.
Your mom's not upset with him that his name won and hers didn't, is she?
Oh, no. She sent me a T-shirt in the mail that says Danger is my middle name.
Oh. And now it is, or it will be. When will this officially happen? Do you know yet?
So I'm waiting until after the new year, just so I can start the year off with a fun note, and it'll be a good time for me. It's right when I'm starting my passport stuff.
Mm-hmm.
So as soon as I get those passports out to the kids, I'll be able to go in and officially change my name and start the year off right.
That's right. 2021 will definitely be a better year for everyone, especially Katie Danger. Eddington. And Danger is the program manager for the Upper Valley Trails Association, and she is a bit of a superstar. Katie, I want to thank you for doing what you do and being on our program this morning.
Of course. It was an absolute pleasure.
Oh, wow. Katie Danger Eddington, thanks again. Just before 10 o'clock, and we're going to be back after this CBS News break here on Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Things are strange right now, but we are here for you at the Warren Store. Whether curbside or in-store, our newly renovated state-of-the-art deli will be putting out sandwiches, soups, salads, and grab-and-go meals. Check out our website for menus and hours. Lattes coming soon. New upstairs, Free People, Burt's Bees baby clothes, Tabitha Henry luminaries, holiday ornaments, cards, and much more. We hope to be online soon for your shopping convenience. Stay safe, follow the governor's guidelines, and have a healthy, happy holiday season. Fun, funky, and friendly, the Warren Store. Main Street, Warren Village.
We're back with Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. When I moved to Vermont 17 years ago, a friend pulled me aside and said, look, there's only 600,000 people in the whole state, so whenever you can, buy Vermont products or buy locally. Do it. I moved here from Miami. Dade County alone had over 3 million people. I knew I had to do my part for Vermont from that point forward. We're going to dive deeper into that message that I received as I began my Vermont life. Joining me now is Heather Pelham. She's the Vermont Commissioner of Tourism and Marketing, the greatest job ever. Heather, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thank you very much. I'm really thrilled to be here.
And listeners, our numbers are 244-1777, also 877-291-8255. That's 877-291-TALK. If you'd like to ask Commissioner Pelham a question or share a Vermont-made product with us that you really love, you can also email us at vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Heather Pelham, when you're talking to people who haven't visited Vermont, what do you tell them about the state?
Well, it's interesting, this concept of buying locally really is part of our Vermont brand. I mean, all of our local independent stores, our restaurants, you know, all the things that really make Vermont special to outsiders, you know, that's because it's about individual Vermonters doing what they love and creating an experience that is unique. So I think that the idea that we have the Vermont collection of unique experiences created by Vermonters themselves, that's what really draws people here. So, you know, these days, more than ever, we're trying to support each other and thinking about how we do that and where we spend our money, there's no better time to really think about supporting our neighbors.
You know, that's a great point, and I'm not slagging on any major hamburger chain, but when I tell people about, you know, a McDonald's in downtown Burlington failing and then Farmhouse coming in and people lining up to get in, or that our Capitol is the only one without a McDonald's, people just, like, their eyes bug out. They just can't believe that would happen in a place. But we really do think about buying locally, even when it's, you know, going out for lunch or dinner, right?
It's very true. And that's really what is one of the reasons that makes Vermont a really attractive place to come visit, because it doesn't look like a lot of other places in the country where you might just be, you know, big brands as being your only alternative. The fact that we have so many choices, I think that's one of the things that's so special about it, is that, you know, we're able to just buy all kinds of different products from all kinds of makers. And the fact that those are makers who are from our communities, or they're, you know, retailers that are part of our communities, that's just as, I think, as special an experience for Vermonters as it is for visitors who come here.
Yeah, you're touching on that. What is it about those Vermont-made products that that you think really makes them so special?
Well, you know, we definitely consider a Vermont-made product to be very high quality. You know, artisan is a word that we use a lot. What it comes down to me is I think that Vermonters have really embraced deliberateness about their life. And so when a Vermonter goes to create something, they're really putting their heart and soul into that. And they're doing it because they love it. And when you do something that you love, you know, really what comes out of that is high quality, you know, a unique product, something that you are proud to have created and then proud to share with others. And I would say it makes someone who buys those products proud to give that to somebody else. It's really about, you know, being that craftsmanship and the quality that makes Vermont-made products so special.
How important is it for Vermonters to buy Vermont?
Well, you know, it's interesting. There's such a ripple effect when you think about how you spend your money. There was actually a study that was done out in Michigan that looked at, for every $100 that is spent, if that money is spent at a locally owned company, 73 cents, so 73% of that purchase stays within the community. If that same purchase is made with a company that's not from that community, only 43% of that money stays within the local community. So when you're buying something locally, you're really investing in your own community. So that money, you know, gets circulated, it goes down to, you know, you're keeping that business owner employed, you're keeping their employees employed. And especially with, you know, the effects that we've seen over the last 9 months with this pandemic, you know, we really can't take for granted the fact that, you know, people are having problems and thinking about, you know, how to keep those businesses afloat. If we're able to just spend a little bit more, and that can be difficult sometimes, but, you know, whatever we can, if we're going to make a purchase, if we can make that purchase locally, you know, you're supporting somebody who is paying taxes in that community, you're supporting jobs in that community, the restaurants are supporting the local farmers, the retailers are supporting the local producers. It's really one big circle.
How much of an impact does tourism usually have on the state of Vermont?
Well, in a normal year, we would see over 13 million visitors come to the state.
Wow.
That's a big number. And that translates into almost $3 billion in economic impact. What has been crazy over the last 9 months is, you know, without that visitor spending, we're actually seeing over $1 million less visitor spending per month. I mean, those are big numbers. So without those visitors coming here, and we all completely understand why, it just puts that much more stress on our food and accommodation sector. They've really been hit very hard through this pandemic.
So you've created. So, go ahead. No, go right ahead.
No, I was going to say. So it's an opportunity, I would say, for Vermonters to think about, well, you know, how can I do the little part that I can do to help support these businesses? And so one of the things that we've done over the last couple months is to create a new website. It's buyvermontmade.com, and it's one place that folks can find different Vermont producers that they can either buy online, or we also, so we have a section for producers and a section for retailers. So if you're looking for anything from specialty foods to home goods to, you know, clothing, toys, Buy Vermont Made is a great resource to check out where you can buy things online or you can buy them in person.
You read my mind. That's exactly where I was going. And it's beautifully done. If anyone hasn't visited it yet, it's called buyvermontmade.com, as Heather mentioned. And there are really some fabulous things. I was noodling around and I've been, you know, in every city and town in this state, and I was finding wonderful new businesses across the state that I've just got to check out. So it really is fun. It's easy to use. Explain what people will find there kind of in detail, Heather.
Sure. Well, we have it when you first come to the site, the first decision you can make is if you're looking for a place that you can shop in person or if you can shop online, because we understand that people, you know, have different habits that way.
Right.
And then there are different categories. So there are categories for toys and gifts, for personal care, beauty products, soaps and so forth, for home goods, for specialty foods, craft beverages, you know, clothing. So you can really kind of, you can literally just browse, you know, for what you're interested in. There's also a search feature. So if you want to search for a store in your area, or if you want to search for a particular retailer that you'd like to support, you can certainly do that. And I agree, it's been fun poking around, and you know, it's one of the things that I love about Vermont is that there's always a new place to discover. There's always a store you hadn't heard of or something quirky and fun out there, and it's just, you know, I think about this time of year is really about traditions and about embracing that, and there's so many things we can't do these days, but I think, you know, one of the traditions of supporting each other is one we can really sink our teeth into this year. And this is a great way to do that.
And is this just for the holidays, or will this stay up? Will we have buyvermontmade.com throughout the year?
Well, you know, it's interesting. This was definitely something that we created thinking of shopping for the holidays. But we definitely are interested in seeing what we can do to keep it going, because it is a great resource. And, you know, we want more than anything to support our local Vermont businesses. So any way we can do that, we're definitely interested in that.
Excellent. Our numbers here are 244-1777, toll-free 877-291-8255. Let's take a call from Bambi, who's calling from Morrisville. Good morning, Bambi. Go right ahead.
Good morning. I'm a retailer of Vermont products. Mm-hmm. And I just want to say that as a person that, you know, is privileged to use the Vermont logo, I feel, you know, a responsibility to everybody else who in the crafts and in the agriculture business that we maintain that quality. Mm-hmm. And do speak up about it and make sure that everybody knows that that Vermont products are the best.
Bambi, that is such an excellent point, and I'd love to have Heather talk more about this. But, you know, that responsibility, that label that we take such pride in, that we look for, you know, the Made in Vermont label. But like Bambi says, you know, making sure that every one of us who uses it, who puts it on their product, is maintaining a certain standard.
Yeah, I mean, it's a great point. There are rules about, you know, if you can say if your product is made in Vermont, and, you know, we definitely do take that seriously. And it's really about the greater Vermont brand. You know, we're all invested in that. And people ask me, you know, what is the Vermont brand? You know, I like to say that it's about all of us. We all have a part in creating that. And that goes to producers who are making products that say made in Vermont. You know, what does that mean? And it even translates to when visitors come here and they meet somebody in a store, or they have an experience at a bed and breakfast, or they go to an attraction, and everybody they meet, you know, every Vermonter they meet becomes part of that experience. And so that collective responsibility to be, you know, good neighbors to each other and to be good stewards of what Vermont stands for, I think that's something that we should all take a lot of pride in.
Heather Pelham, it's, you know, it's pretty easy to shop online, sit at home in the bathroom in the slippers, and then just wait for that box to show up, especially now. So how are Vermont businesses countering that?
Well, I think there's two ways to think about that. On one hand, you know, when you're going into the store and making a purchase, you have the opportunity to meet with the storekeeper and to learn more about the products, and you get that level of customer service that you might not have had. You get, you know, that selection right in front of you. But on the other hand, you know, our Vermont producers, they're selling online as well. So if you prefer to have that convenience of having the box show up at the door, you know, I would say it's like, well, think about that product, and you don't have to order it from, you know, a big box retailer. Chances are you can order that exact same product from a local Vermont store, and it can still get delivered to your door.
I think of some fun things like Bear Pond Books. They'll do a mystery box, and you tell them about someone you're buying for a child, and they'll put together this wonderful box of products, and it's a fun way to shop. I also think of people who order like these online food services, and you can go into a local restaurant or a farmer's market and talk to that producer, that farmer, you know, face to face, look them eye to eye, learn about the meats you're buying, the veg, the cheese, and really feel more connected and know and feel secure about what you're buying.
It's a great point. And if we think about, you know, our Vermont restaurants in particular, you know, now it would be a really great time if folks are thinking about a last minute gift. You know, pick up a gift card from your local yeah. restaurant, you know, someplace that you really, that you enjoy going to. And, you know, we know the challenges these days, but, you know, can you order some takeout, you know, while you're decorating the house, or, you know, buy a gift card. And maybe that's for an occasion that you'll look forward to, you know, months from now, or maybe it's going to be a week from now, but it's a great last minute gift idea, something that we can all do and really to support a sector that has definitely had a tough time these days.
Brilliant idea. And continue on that thought, Heather. Remind people of some of the products that Vermonters can find right here in their own backyard that they might not think about.
Well, I think it's almost anything you can think of. I think at this time of year, like, you know, what are the fun things we don't buy for ourselves? So whether it's, you know, some special soaps or lotions, or is it something you need for your home, a new cutting board, or something for the kids. There's, you know, just really cute clothing out there, all sorts of things that anybody would love. I just, if I look through the Vermont Buy Vermont Made site, I'm just amazed at how many yeah. things are made here. It's almost like there's no category that's not taken into account, whether it's, you know, outdoor gear or jewelry, or, I mean, the specialty foods is something that Vermont is known for. And who can't? Who doesn't enjoy something a little special that's tasty these days?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, you're totally right. So I didn't know exactly what to think, you know, before I went to buyvermontmade.com. And there's just so much and some interesting things. And again, like you said, things you might not have thought about that would be available right here in Vermont, made by Vermonters. So it really is a treasure trove. It's buyvermontmade.com. I want to talk again about tourism. So when we're talking to people from out of state, our friends, our family, about visiting here, Heather, what do we have to remind them about the rules here for visitors?
Well, the rules right now is that we do have a mandatory quarantine for anybody coming into the state. So that means that they definitely need to plan ahead. They're either going to need to quarantine in their home for 14 days, or they can shorten that to 7 days if they receive a negative test result for COVID. And then they would be able to come to the state and stay in one of our lodging establishments and enjoy all the great experiences that they normally would have here. So it can be done. It's just folks need to plan ahead. And, you know, right now it's all about keeping each other safe.
But one thing we should probably mention is Vermonters can visit Vermont, right? They can get around the state, and that's another great way of kind of stimulating our economy, of keeping the dollars local.
It's a great – I can't think of the number of adventures that I have had in the state recently just for not traveling farther afield and discovering new places. It's a little bit of a game sometimes. You'd like to pull out my Vermont gazetteer and say, like, yeah, what road haven't I been on yet? We at the Department of Tourism, we've actually on our website, so the website for the Department of Tourism is vermontvacation.com. We've put together a bunch of different ways for people to get around the state if you're looking for ideas. So we have a section called Explore Vermont, and within that you can find like the chocolate trail and the beer trail and the cheese trail if you're looking for places to go.
Can I go on all three of those at once?
You could try. I don't see why not. We've even put together we have a check yourself, a checklist where it's just kind of a fun game. Like, yes, I've been there or no, that's on my list of activities you can do or places you may not have heard of ways to explore the state. I can share with you actually another combination of a way to explore the state and a gift idea all in one, which just came to me recently. I spoke to a mother and daughter from Weybridge who actually spent the last couple of months through the pandemic traveling around to all 251 towns in the state.
Mm-hmm.
Started out just as kind of an adventure, and they documented their journey by taking photographs of each of the welcome signs in each of the towns.
Nice.
And then at the end of the journey to commemorate it, they put that into a poster. So they've created a poster that's the shape of Vermont that's made up of all the different town names. And they decided to, they are now selling that map, and all the proceeds go to support the Vermont Food Bank, which to me is just like a really nice project that someone put together that just says a lot about Vermont.
That is absolutely brilliant.
and that's, you know, if anyone's interested, they can find that. There's a website called vt251map.com, and you can find that map. So it's a really nice project. And the idea of if we do have some extra time on our hands over the next couple of weeks, you know, think about going out for a drive. It's definitely a safe thing to do. You can, you know, stop at the general store and maybe pick up a sandwich, you know, pop into any establishment, and, you know, people will be so happy to see each other, or, you know, just enjoy your state. We're so lucky to live here.
We really are. The vaccine is arriving here in Vermont, came in yesterday, start to be distributed. It will take a while before everyone has it, but eventually tourism will pick up again. So what efforts is your office making to reacquaint our tourist base with Vermont once the pandemic abates?
Well, we are really looking forward to the day when travel will be safe again. As we've been talking, you know, this whole time, our communities really do depend on those visitors coming in. So we are thinking about all the ways that we can keep Vermont top of mind, as they say, to make sure that people, as they are dreaming through these next, you know, winter months of what they want to do next summer, that they're thinking about Vermont and that we're letting them know all the great experiences they can come here to enjoy. And the nice thing is as well is that, you know, Vermont is really known for outdoor recreation and all the, you know, wide open spaces we have. So we can really encourage folks that they can come here and they can be safe and they can have a great experience and, you know, they can support Vermont at the same time.
Well, and until they can all return, I guess the one thing that's very positive for Vermonters, it might be easier to get lift tickets, you know, more runs down the slopes, and maybe get a table at a restaurant in our usually heavily populated ski towns.
It is true. There will be less folks around, and that is because of the mandatory quarantine. And, you know, we've spent a lot of effort making sure that people really understand that there are rules before they come here, and that's to keep themselves and to keep all of us safe. So if they've planned ahead, and, you know, some of our ski resorts do require reservations for parking, or, you know, you have to plan ahead in terms of if you want to come skiing. But, you know, if you're willing to put in the time, I like to say Vermont is worth the wait. So, we're happy to welcome you, you know, when you've done that, and hopefully you'll have a great experience and come back again.
Heather Pelham is Vermont's Commissioner of Tourism and Marketing. Thanks so much for being on the program today, Heather.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
And that website, again, to check out is buyvermontmade.com. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Things are strange right now, but we are here for you at the Warren Store. Whether curbside or in-store, our newly renovated state-of-the-art deli will be putting out sandwiches, soups, salads, and grab-and-go meals. Check out our website for menus and hours. Lattes coming soon. New upstairs, Free People, Burt's Bees baby clothes, Tabitha Henry luminaries, holiday ornaments, cards, and much more. We hope to be online soon for your shopping convenience. Stay safe, follow the governor's guidelines, and have a healthy, happy holiday season. Fun, funky, and friendly, the Warren Store. Main Street, Warren Village.
This is Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. And I'm speaking with Jeff Smith of the Vermont Youth Conservation Corps. We're talking about his change in midlife at age 50 to a career in forestry. We're also going to talk about the interconnectedness of forests around the country and around the world. And Jess, you know, at age 50, you decided to go into forestry. So where and what did you do to get you here to Vermont after going? You went to UMass Amherst to get a master's degree.
Correct. Yes. Went to UMass and I knew this area. I knew sort of the Warren, Waitsfield, Montpelier area from being in a ski house. So I knew the terrain. I knew it was a place I really wanted to be. And so that was sort of a big part of the decision. But I kind of just decided to move. Bought a place up here, and I didn't have a job. I just wanted to be here and pursue forestry, and that's what I did. I think like a lot of Vermonters, you know, I had an array of hats. I did different things to keep some money coming in, but also keep my feet wet in forestry. And you know, to be frank, age has an impact on your ability to get a job, I believe. So I wasn't able to get anything in forestry for a while, which was a surprise given that degree that I had. But I stayed involved as much as possible in the discipline. And so I did things, with the Society of American Foresters. They have a strong New England presence. I did volunteer things for them. I did some things for the State Sustainable Jobs Fund to help with some research and some of their efforts. So I did some maple sugaring. Mm-hmm. So I stayed as involved as I could, and at the same time was doing some light carpentry and really odd jobs in some situations, you know, just to sort of keep me afloat and maintain a living here.
You became a real Vermonter.
Hey,
Jess, I'm going to cut you off for just a moment, and we've got Fred calling from Newbury. Fred, go right ahead.
Hey, I'm wondering if the forest has ever given a forest archaeology tour.
All right, Fred, let's ask Jess about that. Forest archaeology, anything in that area, Jess Smith?
It's not something I'm familiar with. Mm-hmm. You know, you might want to pursue that through the state, Forest Parks and Rec. That would be my first guess.
Yep. All right. I do want to get to something I mentioned at the top, and that was a piece that was written by Rachel Hellman that appeared in Sunday's Boston Globe. So how did that piece come about, Jess Smith?
That's sort of a perfect example of serendipity, almost a happenstance and very unexpected situation. So, you know, we do some pretty extensive training for our crews. And Rachel was on a crew at BYCC this fall, and they were designing, building, and installing kiosks on state lands, state parks, trailheads, state forests. And so I was at one of these trainings. We were having lunch on the field in Richmond behind our office. And I was sitting next to a couple of crew members, just struck up a conversation. And, you know, she's interested in environmental journalism. And also she was just fascinated by hearing more about forestry and sort of, you know, what I had done and a little bit more about the field in general. And she got a hold of me a couple of weeks later and said that she had the possibility of writing a piece for the Boston Globe and wanted to know if I would do an interview. So I sort of, you know, talked to her for an hour and a half or so about these things that we're going over. Yeah. And she turned it into an article, and sure enough, it was published in print on Sunday in the Globe.
It was great to see. So, for listeners, Jas, explain the premise of the piece, you know, the connectivity between forests here and forests elsewhere.
Absolutely. I'm glad to. A lot of that connectivity is market-based. In other words, the forests that we see in New England, you know, have taken hundreds of thousands of years to develop, and if there wasn't sort of human activity and transportation, they would be continuing to grow but somewhat isolated. But because of the economic realm and because of globalism generally, forests and the products that come from forests principally are very connected to other places. There's just, as with any economic good, there's a huge substitution effect. So that, for example, if for some reason we no longer harvested hardwoods, or if that harvesting, you know, was much lessened for some reason, that wood or a very similar wood would come from somewhere to the world markets. And there's a very good chance that that wood would be sourced from a place that doesn't have the sort of well-formulated and sophisticated regulations that we have for our forests. They could come from land clearing in the Amazon. It could come from Papua New Guinea, where there's just tremendous devastation. So there's a huge substitution effect, and for that reason, if harvesting is decreased or increased in one place, there's usually an offset. You can't identify every piece of that sort of framework, but there's a huge relationship there between our forests and others. And then briefly, the other unfortunate connection, also through globalism, is invasive species. And that's sort of a very negative way that forests are connected, unfortunately.
Right. So we only have a few more minutes left. How does this affect the forest management and conservation that we do here in Vermont and New England?
Well, one thing it does is it's an additional reason why we need to have the regulations that we do, and not just regulations, but it's also sort of mindset and personal options. In other words, people can, if they have a small land holding as a private landowner, they can read extensively about different ways to harvest their property. You know, there's a huge spectrum there. There's a huge spectrum in terms of sort of how much to harvest and when to harvest. But the key thing is to actually plan forward, understand what you're doing and why you're doing it, and look at the different aspects of harvesting. Look at the ramifications of what species you might be taking, which ones you might be saving, how you might be getting equipment into the property. You know, all of those things are critical. And, you know, that's just an extra reason why we need to pay attention to that, mm-hmm. is because of this substitution effect.
And, Jas Smith, I'm going to guess that there will be no more sudden career pivots for you at this time.
Well, You will be the first to know.
All right. You make sure you call me if you're thinking about that. Jess Smith is the Conservation Forestry Manager at the Vermont Youth Conservation Corps. Jess, it's been a pleasure having you on the program today. Thanks so much.
Well, thank you very much.
And that is our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint is produced by Taylor Dobbs and was directed by Lee Cattell and Danny McEvergan. Our email address is vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. You can feel free to suggest topics or guests. You can listen to past podcasts or episodes of Vermont Viewpoint by downloading our podcast at wdevradio.com. The governor's COVID-19 response news conference is up just a few minutes after CBS News. I'm Rick Singeri, and I'll meet you back here tomorrow.